Dean of Student Life, the Association of Fraternity Presidents, the Brown Christian Fellowship, Campus Cranston Christian Fellowship Campus Outreach, Brown Young Republicans, the Lecture Board, and the Committee for the Debate would like to thank you for coming out to tonight's program, Origin, Evolution versus Special Creation. Now, I'd like to introduce the moderator for the debate, Brown University Professor of History, Dr. Donald Rohr.
Thank you and good evening. I've been asked to remind you that there's to be no smoking in the auditorium. The subject of our discussion tonight has been under debate for more than a century. And while the issues may remain unresolved and controversial after generations of talking, the terms have been somewhat better defined and the level of debate has been raised. To give you a brief example of what I mean of the low level of debate when the debate began, let me refer to a discussion held at Oxford University in 1860, within a few months after Darwin published The Origin of Species. The antagonists were the Bishop of Oxford, Samuel Wilberforce, also known as Soapy Sam, and Thomas Henry Huxley, later known as Darwin's Bulldog. Wilberforce spoke to an admiring audience with such wit and sarcasm, such gusto and ingenuity, that he was carrying even some of the sober scientists with him. Dizzy with success, he turned at one point and asked Huxley with modest courtesy whether it was through his grandfather or his grandmother that he claimed descent from a monkey. Huxley, until that point, was near despair, but when Wilberforce asked that question, Huxley turned to a grave scientist sitting next to him and said, "The Lord hath delivered him into my hands." When Huxley spoke, he briefly outlined Darwin's arguments, clearly outlined Darwin's arguments, alluded to the bishop's ignorance of the sciences involved, and then concluded with his own argumentum ad hominem by saying that he would not be ashamed to have a monkey for his ancestor, but he would be ashamed to be connected with a man who used great gifts to obscure the truth. The hostile audience applauded him as vigorously as they had the bishop, and a woman swooned. The debate tonight is not about monkeys, nor is it about Genesis. It is about scientific evidence and scientific explanation. And I've been asked by the debate committee to stress this point, that neither the debate committees nor the sponsors view either thing as more religious or theistic than the other. The resolution of the debate is this: the theory of evolution is superior to the theory of special creation as an explanation for all the scientific evidence related to origins. The format of the debate, as you can see from the program, will vary from that usually observed in intercollegiate debating. The negative will speak first for 50 minutes, will be followed by the affirmative with another 50-minute presentation. There will then be a 15-minute intermission before the rebuttals begin. During the opening statements, the 50-minute statements, you are asked, in the interest of brevity, to withhold applause or any other expression of approval or disapproval until the speaker has finished. Speaking now for the affirmative, or speaking later for the affirmative, will be Kenneth Miller, Professor of Biology in Brown's Division of Biology and Medicine, speaking for the negative position, and therefore, in our format, the first to speak will be Dr. Henry Morris, President of the Institute for Creation Research in San Diego. Dr. Morris.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rohr. Privileged to be here at Brown University, my first visit to this great school. Although I feel that I know quite a bit about it, my friend and colleague, Dr. Tom Barnes, who is the new dean of our graduate school at ICR, professor of physics at the University of Texas in El Paso, did his graduate work here and has spoken very highly of this school, and particularly his professor, Dr. R.B. Lindsay, one of the great physicists of our generation. So it's a privilege to be here. also have enjoyed meeting my opponent in this dialogue, Dr. Miller. Appreciate very much both his attitude and his ability. And I trust that even though we may be on opposite sides of the debate tonight, that we will become and remain good friends, because I certainly would want to do that and highly respect him. We're going to be speaking tonight on the issue of creation versus evolution, but strictly on a scientific basis. We recognize that both of these have religious implications and sociological implications and so on, and these topics might be the subject of other debates, but tonight we want to discuss the relative scientific merits of these two models of origins and development of the universe and of life. Of course, I believe that creationism is a better scientific model. And I think that the sort of meeting that we have tonight is a good thing to do, because we're not so much interested in winning debates as we are winning a hearing for creationism. For some reason, the creation model has been excluded from public education for a long time. And we believe that that needs to be changed, and we think that this is encouraging that we'd have this kind of a meeting tonight. Hope it'll be indicative of many more in the future. Regardless of which is right, these are two models that are of great concern and represent worldviews for many people, and so they need thorough discussion. Matter of fact, there are now thousands of scientists who have become creationists, and these are in fairly recent years. As a matter of fact, most of us, including myself, once were evolutionists, but have become convinced that creation is a better scientific explanation. And so even though we represent a minority in science, it is a significant and a growing minority. And furthermore, as far as the population as a whole is concerned, polls indicate that the majority of the general population believes in creation, and a great majority believes that both should be taught in our public schools, no matter which one they personally prefer. And I think that as long as we deal only with the scientific aspects of this issue, why, it's perfectly appropriate to do that in the public institution. Now, I recognize certainly right at the beginning that it is not possible to prove creation scientifically, nor can it be disproved scientifically. And I'd say the same thing about evolution. Neither is provable or falsifiable in the ultimate scientific sense of being observable and testable in the laboratory by the scientific method. These represent worldviews. They're far more than simply biological theories. They represent worldviews in every field of science, and so all of us are concerned and interested in them. As far as the non-testable nature of evolution is concerned, some might question that, so let me quote from Dr. Paul Ehrlich of Stanford, one of our leading evolutionary ecologists and biologists, and he says this: "Our theory of evolution has become one which cannot be refuted by any possible observations. Every conceivable observation can be fitted into it." And at first one might think, well, that makes it a very good theory. If everything fits it, it must be a good theory. But no, that's exactly what's wrong with it. It's so broad and so flexible that no matter what we see, we can explain it in terms of evolution. It cannot be tested. And therefore, it's not really a scientific theory or a scientific hypothesis, but it is a very powerful model or paradigm, if you wish, or system, framework. Dr. Ehrlich goes on to say, "It is outside of empirical science. No one can think of ways in which to test it. Ideas, either without basis or based on a few laboratory experiments carried out in extremely simplified systems, have attained currency far beyond their validity. They have become part of an evolutionary dogma, accepted by most of us as part of our training." Well, now, dogma is not a scientific term. A dogma is something you believe or don't believe. And although Dr. Ehrlich certainly believes in evolution, nevertheless, he does recognize that it cannot really be proved or falsified. Probably the greatest philosopher of science of our day, Karl Popper, has said essentially the same thing. He says, "I've come to the conclusion that Darwinism is not a testable scientific theory, but it's a metaphysical research program, a possible framework for testable scientific theories." And as far as Popper is concerned, he is certainly one of the world's great philosophers of science. Dr. Peter Medawar, one of the leading evolutionary biologists of Great Britain, says he thinks Popper is incomparably the greatest philosopher of science that has ever been. So his opinion certainly should carry weight. And in the foreword to the 1971 edition of Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, you find this statement. Of course, I know and you know that Charles Darwin doesn't revise his book anymore, but every once in a while a new edition comes out with a new foreword written by a current leader in the field of evolutionary studies, and this one by L. Harrison Matthews, a fellow of the Royal Society of Britain. And in his foreword, he says this: belief in the theory of evolution is thus exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, though neither up to the present is capable of proof. So we think the proper approach is to define two scientific models of origins and development of the universe, of the earth, of life, of man, of all things. Then use these models as vehicles for correlating and explaining and predicting scientific data. And the model which does the best job of that, with a smaller number of secondary modifications to make it fit the data, is the one most likely perhaps to be true, even though we can't prove it to be true in the ultimate scientific sense. One can always make any observable data fit either of these models. They cannot be repeated. They're historical events or sequences of events. We can't repeat history or get in a time machine and go back and see what happened. And so therefore we can't ultimately prove or disprove either one. So all we can do is to use the models as vehicles for correlating the data that we do see and then decide which one does the best job. And always you can make either model fit any set of data by expanding the model, modifying the model. And we would just suggest that the model which fits the data more directly with a smaller number of secondary modifications to make it fit, as Dr. Ehrlich pointed out, every conceivable observation can be made to fit, but the smaller number of modifications necessary to do that would indicate that probably the model is the better model, although we finally have to decide whether we want to believe it or not in either case. Now, of course, it's very important to define our terms. Be sure we understand what we're speaking about when we speak of evolution and creation. If you want to use the term special creation or supernatural creation, that's all right. Let me just understand, in terms of our terminology tonight, evolution and creation are the two models of origins. They're not the same. That does not at all suggest that one has to be, for example, an atheist to believe in evolution. I myself was a theistic evolutionist for a long time, all through college. It's simply to say that in terms of the scientific discussion, we're dealing with two different concepts, evolution and creation. Now with that, I'd like to have the first slide, if I may please, and the lights dimmed. And I would like to define the evolution model in the terms Sir Julian Huxley used. He said more than that. Huxley, of course, was probably the world's leading evolutionist of our generation until he died a few years ago. And so his definition ought to be fairly comprehensive and accepted. He says, evolution in the extended sense can be defined as a directional and essentially irreversible process occurring in time, which in its course gives rise to an increase of variety and an increasingly high level of organization in its products. Our present knowledge, he says, indeed forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. Now you note the key words there. Is this on? The key words are directional process. It's not simply back and forth or up and down, but it's directional, and it's irreversible, and furthermore, it leads towards higher levels of organization. That is? Okay, back to the key words. The definition, directional, irreversible, higher levels of organization. And of course, in the construct that usually is presented, at least today, the universe is essentially infinitely old in terms of space and time and matter, and perhaps the universe in its present form may date from 18 to 20 to 30 billion years. The solar system, perhaps 4.5 to 5 billion years. And then this planet and the complex chemicals on this planet acquired the ability to replicate themselves and life began maybe 4 billion years ago. Life in a complex form, multicellular form, perhaps 1 billion years ago. And so on, invertebrates gave rise to vertebrates, fishes to amphibians, then reptiles, mammals, birds, finally man several million years ago. So a tremendous increase in organization and complexity or information with the ages. Now, one other key point there, according to Huxley and according to most evolutionists, the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. So the concept is not of an external supernatural agent directing this, although perhaps he's back there somehow behind it. But the universe is operating itself, transforming itself by its own properties and processes into higher levels of organization, a process of self-transformation, as he says. Now from that, we would glean the key concepts, as I would view it anyway, of the evolution model. In the first place, it would postulate that This universe, this world, and life has a continuing origin. That is, the processes which brought it into existence and into the present level are still going on, and they're natural processes, not supernatural. And there's been a net increase in complexity. Not all things have increased in complexity, but there has been a net increase from amoeba to man, or from particles, if you will, to people, molecules to man, as one book puts it. Tremendous increase in organization. And Earth history is dominated by uniformitarianism. That is the philosophy that Earth structures and systems can be explained in terms of present-day processes operating in the same ways, roughly the same rates that they do now, dominated by uniformitarianism. Now, we would contrast that with the creation model, define that just exactly as the opposite. Instead of continuing natural origin, we postulate a completed supernatural origin. Now, not everything, of course, but the basic laws of nature, the basic universe, the basic systems, the basic kinds of plants and animals, especially mankind, were brought into existence complete and functioning, highly organized right from the beginning by processes which are not going on now. And since they're not natural processes, which we observe now, you can use whatever term you wish, supernatural, preternatural, whatever. At any rate, they're not natural. We just call them supernatural. Created processes, and this is where the term special creation might come from. And there's been a net decrease in complexity. That is, we would postulate maybe horizontal changes, conservation in the universe, but if there is any vertical change, since one cannot improve perfection, and the Creator by definition would make things the way they ought to be, which would be perfect for their purposes, any vertical change, as it were forced by some extraneous agent, would cause a downward drift, not upward, and so there would be a net decrease in complexity. And then we would suggest that Earth history is dominated by catastrophism, that is, processes operating intensely rather than uniformly over the ages. Now, obviously, these are opposite to each other. And so, therefore, it isn't appropriate when we define the terms this way to speak of believing in both creation and evolution. One can certainly believe in a form of evolution that is operated by God. We call that theistic evolution. One can be an atheistic evolutionist, or a theistic evolutionist, or a pantheistic evolutionist, but the choice between these concepts is not a scientific choice. It's the same scientific data, the same geological age system, and so on. In any case, that's a theological question, which we're not discussing this evening. But the choice between creation as defined and evolution as defined can be discussed scientifically, and the two models can be compared on a scientific basis. That's what trying to do. Now, what I would like to do then is to look at the creation model in particular and use this model as a means of predicting data, if you want to put it that way. That is, imagining what we would expect to see if creation were true and we didn't know what was there. Correlating data, explaining data. For example, let's take the array of plants and animals in the living world. Now, if we didn't know what they were, if we were coming, say, from outer space somewhere and didn't know what we were going to find on the Earth, and a creationist would look at the creation model and say, well, since the Creator made all things and He made them perfect with their own structures for their own purposes, what we would expect to find would be an array of organisms, different kinds of organisms, each with its own structure for its own purpose. And we would suppose that these different organisms would not be rigidly fixed because they would have to adapt to different environments, so we would expect that there would be a principle of conservation imposed on the created kinds of organisms to enable them to adapt to different environments without becoming extinct. So we would expect to find a great deal of horizontal change or variation. Some would call it microevolution within the created kind at the same level of information and complexity, adapting to different environments, changing the coloration or something like that to do that. Otherwise, they would become extinct if the environment changed the least little bit, and that would be contrary to the purpose of the Creator. So we would expect to find a conservation principle and a wide range of horizontal within the kinds. And if vertical changes in the kinds, they would go down toward disorder, not upward towards higher order. That's what we would expect to find. And of course, I don't think we need to argue the point that that's exactly what we do find in the actual world of plants and animals. We have, for example, many varieties of dogs. One could call this microevolution if you wish, but all the dogs have come from the same ancestor, probably the wolf, about 4,000 years ago. It doesn't take millions of years to do that, but they're still dogs. And we have many varieties of cats, but nothing in between the cat and the dog. And the same with all the other kinds of organisms. Horizontal changes within the kinds, gaps between the kinds, exactly as predicted by the creation model. It fits the facts as we see them, in the living world, and we don't have to explain anything or modify anything. It's just exactly the way it should be. Now, if we didn't find that, for example, if we found a continuum of cats and dogs and all kinds of animals, an evolutionary sort of a flux in nature with one kind becoming a different kind, and instead of having cats and dogs, we'd have cats and then 90% cats, 10% dogs, and 80%, 20%, and so on, an evolutionary continuum in nature, if we did find something like that, of course, that would be tremendously hard to explain in terms of any concept except evolution. That would be perhaps the most obvious prediction of evolutionism if we didn't know anything different. But of course, the fact that we don't find that doesn't mean that evolution isn't true. It just means that we have to find a way of modifying the basic evolutionary model to explain how organisms that did have common ancestors and that evolved in the same world, in the same environment, say like cats and dogs, somehow got to be different. Well, maybe we can do that. But you do have to modify the model to do it. And the creation model predicts the facts directly. Now, that seems maybe to be an exception, and I wanted you to see that because maybe somebody might think, well, I was wrong about the cats and dogs. This was published on the front page of the San Diego paper several years ago, and maybe you saw it too. This is a DAT, which is a 50% dog and 50% cat, halfway between, hybrid dog and cat. And, of course, when that was published, a lot of my evolutionary friends sent that to me because I'd been saying that doesn't happen, and they said, see, you were wrong. This proves they had a common ancestor. But what most people didn't see was about 3 days later, way back in the inside of the paper, a little one-inch column in which the publisher of that photograph admitted it was a hoax. In other words, there's no such thing as a DAT or a COG. Cats are cats and dogs are dogs. Always been, as far as all the evidence goes. Now, I've mentioned the possibility then of there being a conservation principle, keeping the kinds as they are. And if there are any changes, they would go downward, for example, a mutation or, for example, extinction. And we do see this in the actual world. But now, as a matter of fact, the creation model is much broader than simply biology and the organisms. It really is a worldview, and so we would expect to find this kind of a principle operating throughout the whole world of nature. That is, a basic principle of conservation of the original creation. And if there are any vertical changes, they would be downward, a principle of disintegration, principle of conservation and disintegration. Evolution, on the other hand, should be able to predict a principle of innovation, bringing things into existence, and then integration, building them up into higher levels of existence. And since evolution, presumably, is still going on, that is, it assumes that natural processes, continuing as they have in the past, are still doing the same as they have in the past, we would expect, at least at first, to be able to see vertical evolution taking place from one kind to a higher kind. There's nothing in the basic model that says it has to be so slow you can't see it. And, of course, if we could see it, if we could see cats turning into dogs or something like that, obviously creationists would have to believe in evolution because we could see it, and science is what you see. And so, at least as a first assumption, we would be justified in looking for real vertical changes in terms of the evolution model, not in terms of the creation model. The creation model say, no, you won't see that. Well, in terms of what kind of change can take place in nature, what are the laws of change, the laws of science that govern all fields of science? Well, no doubt most of you know that there are two basic laws that govern all systems of matter and energy, including both non-living and living systems, all systems, are governed by what are known as the first and second laws of thermodynamics. These are, in a very real way, nothing but what we would expect, predictions from the creation model, a principle of conservation, enabling things to take place, changes to take place on a horizontal level, one kind of energy to be converted to another kind, for example, matter to change its states, or even matter and energy to be converted, but the totality of the creation, the totality of matter and energy, which is really everything in the universe, would be constant, principle of conservation. We would also expect to find a principle of disintegration. Even though the quantity may stay the same, the quality would go down. Well, as a matter of fact, that's exactly what we do find. In other words, the prediction of the creation model fits exactly what we find in terms of the laws of change in science. The evolution model would predict that things go up with time in terms of information, organization, complexity, order. Creation model predicts they go down with time. And the fact is, we have encountered a universal principle of change in nature that says in every system there's a tendency to go down toward disorganization, toward disinformation, toward simplicity, toward chaos, finally, and toward death. Now, these two laws of thermodynamics, they are called that simply because they were first discovered in the study of thermodynamics, but they're much broader, of course, than the study of heat engines. They relate to every field of science. They're universal laws of science, the two best approximations to universal laws of science that we have. The first law is the law of energy conservation, and here this is defined, or at least discussed, by Isaac Asimov, who is the most prolific science writer, I guess, of our day. He speaks of the first law. He says, this law is the most universal, secure generalization from science that scientists have ever been able to make. If there is such a thing as a law of science, this is it. And he says, no one knows why this is true. Why is energy conserved? Nobody knows why. Whenever you begin a question with the word why, you know that you're outside the scope of science. Science can deal with the what, the how, but not with the why. And so nobody knows why this is true. All we know is that it always works. Whenever it's been tested, energy is always conserved, energy including matter. Now, that's the principle of conservation of quantity, but there's the second law, which is the principle of decay of quality. And here this is defined by Harold Bloom. He says that the second law of thermodynamics has as one of its consequences that all real processes go irreversibly. Any given process in this universe is accompanied by change in magnitude of a quantity called the entropy. The entropy measures the randomness or the lack of orderliness of the system. The greater the randomness, the greater the entropy. And I want you to contrast that with the definition of evolution by Sir Julian Huxley. Both of them say that their principles are universal principles. All real processes, Blum says, the whole of reality, Huxley says, both of them say that their processes are irreversible. The only difference is one goes up and the other goes down. One towards higher levels of organization, the other towards lower levels of organization. And we believe that this is a problem for evolution because here we have two universal principles of change, each of which is defined as the converse of the other. And if words mean anything, how can they both be true as universals? And maybe we can find situations where they can be accommodated locally, but in terms of a universal principle, it looks like we have a conflict. Now, this illustrates the two laws. The horizontal scale is time, and the vertical scale is information or energy or order, various ways you can define the concept of energy and entropy. Energy basically is the capacity to do work, and work is moving forces through distances. Entropy can be defined various ways, either in terms of it's in relation to the disorder of a structured system or the non-availability of the energy of a thermodynamic system, or the garbled information in a communication system. There are various ways, and all of them are equivalent to each other. Mathematically, they're described by the same equations. The various ways you can describe any kind of a system, either in terms of an information system, an energy system, or a structured system, but always the entropy principle says that the order goes down, the information goes down, the available energy goes down. In other words, the time zero, as it's called, points down. Now, this is a universal law of science, and it does seem to conflict with the universal principle of evolution. And so how do you make a choice? Well, I would suggest that you go with science. Remember that evolution cannot be tested scientifically. It's a model, a system. The second law of thermodynamics has been tested by science and on all kinds of systems, from the very smallest to the very largest, and no exception has ever been found to either one of these principles of thermodynamics. So it does seem as though, at least as far as the universe is concerned, why we have a problem. Now, some would say, well, thermodynamics only applies to a closed system. All right, but the universe is a closed system. Remember what Huxley said? The whole of reality, a process of self-transformation. The universe is a closed system, transforming itself. And if you begin back with something like, say, the Big Bang, primeval explosion, explosions don't produce order, they produce disorder. And so you start out with chaos and with highly disorder. And so how, in terms of a closed system that begins with disorder, are we ever going to evolve the highly complex systems of the present universe? It does look like there's a problem with evolution. Maybe some way it can be resolved. But you see, the creation model doesn't have a problem here. It doesn't have to resolve itself in any way because the creation model doesn't have to explain the second law of thermodynamics. Creation law predicts the second law of thermodynamics, fits the facts directly. Well, what about the evolutionist? What does he say to this? Well, we don't have time really to get into that. But he will say, well, if you just realize that evolution goes very slowly, And what we see now in terms of what we call macroevolution, if we let that go on long enough over millions of years, it would become macroevolution. And these small horizontal changes would somehow become big vertical changes, and we'd have the tremendous array of organisms that constitute the history of the evolution of life on the planet. But you have to have a long time for that. So you have to be patient and realize it takes time. Well, so where do we go to see that? Remember, evolution is presented to us as a proved fact of science in many places, so science ought to be capable of being observed, and where do we go to see the proof, then, of evolution? And so they suggest to the fossil record. Now, there we have, in the rocks of the Earth's crust, the remains of millions and billions, as a matter of fact, of animals and plants that once lived and died and been buried in the rocks. And so we have preserved for us in the lithologic records of ancient times the record of the evolution of life from simple organisms way back in the Cambrian period, 600 million years ago, on up to complex human beings in the Pleistocene epoch over the last maybe a million or so years. Tremendous increase in complexity. We have it actually documented for us in the rocks of the Earth's crust. And at first this sounds rather convincing, until we ask again the question, what would the creation model predict you would find in the fossil record? We recognize that there's been a history of life on the Earth, and we recognize that we can find some clues to that history in the fossil record and the rocks of the Earth's crust. What would we expect to find in terms of the creation model? What would the creation model permit us to predict in terms of the fossil record if we didn't know what was there? What would we expect to find? Well, what we would expect to find in terms of the creation model in the fossil record is exactly the same sort of thing we find in the present world. That is, horizontal changes within kinds, gaps between kinds, no transitions from one kind to another kind. We wouldn't expect to find any of these intermediate forms between different forms of life because, according to the creation model, they never existed, so we wouldn't find them. And so we would not expect to find intermediate forms between basic kinds of organisms in the fossil record. We might find some extinct kinds. Lots of extinct kinds might be predicted because, after all, there is a principle of disintegration operating in the framework of the creation model. So we're not surprised when we find such things as dinosaurs becoming extinct, but that doesn't tell us how the dinosaurs came to be in the first place. Extinction is the opposite of evolution. Well, now, the fossil record should give us the real history of life, if it's possible to find it at all, because this does preserve for us the actual record of whatever lifespan or whatever Earth history we have. And so, whether evolution or creation, we ought to be able to test the two models in terms of the fossil record if we can test it anywhere. The evolutionists, it seems like, would expect to find some intermediate forms. In fact, tremendous numbers of intermediate forms in the fossil record. After all organisms did come from a common ancestor in the same world. Take the cats and dogs, for example. They must have come from some common ancestor not too long ago, and they live in about the same kind of environment and evolved by the same process, so there ought to be some intermediates and some connecting links between the primeval ancestor of the cats and dogs, and the modern cats on the one hand and the dogs on the other. Even though we can't find intermediates in the present array of organisms, we ought to find some in the fossils. After all, billions and billions of fossils have been documented, and some of these ought to be those intermediates which must have existed. Back in Darwin's day, Darwin knew that that all these links were missing, but he said it's just because we don't have enough fossils collected yet. But then over 100 years have passed, and lots of fossils have been collected. But again, the same gaps that existed in Darwin's day existed in our day. And again, I'll need to document that. Let me just quote, without going into detail, from Dr. David Roth, who is certainly one of our top young paleontologists today, curator of geology at the Field Museum of Natural History, certainly knows the fossil record, and here's what he says about it. He says, instead of finding the gradual unfolding of life, what geologists of Darwin's time and geologists of the present day actually find is a highly uneven and jerky record. That is, species appear in the sequence very suddenly, show little or no change during their existence in the record, then abruptly go out of the record. And it isn't always clear, in fact, it's rarely clear, that the descendants were actually any better adapted than their predecessors. In other words, biological improvement is hard to find. Now, can you check why the slide doesn't work? Move. Okay, that's the standard fossil record. That's the geological column, as it's presumably preserved in the rocks of the Earth's crust. And most of you are familiar with this. Vertical scale is time, and it's as though there's a cross-section cut down through the Earth's crust from the surface down to the crystalline rocks on the basement, showing the succession of different forms of life over the ages.
And that looks impressive at first until you look more closely and you see that all those forms of life that you find there, except a few that are extinct, such as the trilobites and the dinosaurs, really look quite modern. Matter of fact, as Dr. Ropp says, when a species appears in the fossil record, it appears suddenly and abruptly and fully developed, stays that way for a while, and then goes out of the record. You don't find any evidence of intermediate forms or improved forms, beginning forms, or anything like that. Somebody might say, well, what about the horse? Isn't that an example of an intermediate series? Well, Dr. Ropp goes on to say about that. He says, the record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky, and ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. By this, I mean that some of the classic cases of Darwinian change in the fossil record, such as the evolution of the horse in North America, have had to be discarded or modified as a result of more detailed information. So the horse series, which is supposedly the best, really isn't a family tree at all. It's a bush, as some people have called it, with all kinds of contradictions and no clear example that one kind has evolved into another kind at all. And if that isn't a good example, then that's the best of where or any. And Dr. Ropp says they don't seem to exist. Now, Dr. Ropp is an evolutionist, don't misunderstand, but he's one of a younger group of evolutionists who are saying, well, we've got to recognize the fact that these gaps are real, and the old idea of slow and gradual change by mutation and natural selection just doesn't seem to work. We have to have a new concept of evolution which allows for sudden changes in small populations. Well, maybe so. They call it punctuated equilibrium. That is, populations stay the same for a long time, what they call stasis, and then there's a punctuation in a small population, rapid change, and this may be over considerable time in terms of human life, but rapid in terms of so-called geologic time. At any rate, there's no evidence of what took place because all of a sudden there's a different group of organisms and no evidence of any intermediates in between. And so, now people are saying, well, the idea of microevolution and macroevolution are really two different things. For example, Stephen Jay Gould, one of the leading evolutionists today in paleobiology in 1980, says this about that. He says, our model of punctuated equilibria holds that evolution is concentrated in events of speciation and that successful speciation is an infrequent event punctuating the stasis of large populations that do not alter in fundamental ways during the millions of years that they endure. And then he says this, referring now to Dr. Stephen Stanley, who's recently published a book called Macroevolution, and Stanley argues at great length and with great force that the two kinds of evolution, what we call variation or horizontal change, and macroevolution or vertical change, are not the same thing at all. He says macroevolution is, as Stanley argues, decoupled from microevolution, and so on. Just last fall, there was a conference in Chicago at the Field Museum in which, according to the reports, most of the leading evolutionists of our day were present discussing this very problem. And let me just read what Science Magazine said, reporting the conference. They say, a wide spectrum of researchers gathered at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History under the simple conference titled Macroevolution. The central question of the Chicago conference was whether the mechanisms underlying microevolution can be extrapolated to explain the phenomena of macroevolution. At the risk of doing violence to the positions of some of the people at the meeting, the answer can be given as a clear no. The majority of the leading evolutionists today, apparently, particularly among the younger evolutionists, say that microevolution and macroevolution are two different things. Dr. Gould even uses the term hopeful monster, returning to the terminology of Richard Goldsmith 40 years ago. Something like this, that a reptile laid an egg, as Goldsmith said, and then a bird hatched out of the egg. Just rapid change, sudden change, because there are no intermediate forms that one can point to as evidence of gradual change. Well, maybe so. One cannot be sure about this because, once again, we can't get in a time machine and go back and see where that happened. This is a modification of the model, once again, to make it explain why we find no intermediate forms. The fact is, there are no intermediate forms that have been found. And this is, of course, a precise prediction of the creation model. Maybe the evolution model can explain why there are no intermediate forms, but be a lot better proof of evolution if we could find an intermediate series. If we could find, for example, a whole series of organisms showing how the invertebrate gradually evolved into the vertebrate, or the fish into the amphibian. If we could find a series of forms showing how they gradually changed, the feet and legs of the amphibian, or the fins of the fish gradually changed in the feet and legs of the amphibian, and the scales of the reptile gradually becoming the feathers of the bird, if we could find these intermediate structures somewhere, a series of them, then, of course, creationists would have a hard time accepting anything but evolution as the explanation for that. Well, we don't find those, and maybe that proves that evolution took place rapidly like this. It does seem to us like what the evolutionist is saying, something like this. The reason you don't see any evolution in the present world is because it goes too slow for you to see. And then the reason why you don't see it in the fossil world is because it went too fast for you to see. But the fact is, you don't see it anywhere. And science is supposed to be what you can see. In other words, evolutionists have to walk by faith, not by sight. And that's okay. It's a faith, something you can believe. You have to believe creation too, but they're on the same level. Belief in special creation is parallel to belief in evolution, as Dr. Matthews says. Well, now, we would suggest that the gaps in the fossil record are not a problem at all for the creation model. We don't have to explain why the gaps are there. The creation model predicts the gaps, and sure enough, once again, the creation model fits the facts exactly as they're found, whether in the present world or the past world or the possible world, as expressed in terms of the laws of science, the laws of thermodynamics. The creation model predicts the facts exactly as they are. The evolution model has to continually be modified to explain the facts and to correlate the facts to make it fit. Once again, we haven't proved one or the other, but the creation model does do a good job of correlating and predicting the facts. Well, now, the next question would be, well, if this geological column does not really teach evolution, exactly what does it teach? What is the meaning of this array of organisms in the rocks of the Earth's crust? Now we come to the third aspect of the creation model, and that is that Earth history is dominated by catastrophism rather than uniformitarianism. Now, let's just ask again, what would the creation model predict with respect to the actual structures, the physical structures of the rocks of the Earth's crust? We would predict that they would give evidence of catastrophe rather than slow, uniform processes. And when we go and look at those structures, that's what we find. Now, when I was going to graduate school, and that's been way back, I know, in the dark ages, a long time ago, when I was at University of Minnesota and I was in geology, and in those days, uniformitarianism was the watchword in geology. The present is the key to the past. That was the watchword of geology, uniformitarianism. And catastrophism was a bad word. You just didn't use that word in those days at all if you expected to get through the course. But now, it's different. Now, there are many articles in the geological literature that speak of catastrophism. I know of two societies that are for the study of catastrophic geology, and these are not creationist societies, just geological societies. So now catastrophism is beginning to come back into the picture again. Dr. Gould himself is advocating that, along with the idea of rapid evolution, also rapid destruction, too, in terms of catastrophic geology, and so are many others. Now, I've been saying this for a long time. I've been sort of sticking my neck out and saying that you really couldn't explain the rocks of the Earth's crust, the sedimentary rocks particularly, which were formed by hydraulic processes, which happens to be my own field, hydraulics. See, you just can't explain these rocks by natural slow processes of erosion and sedimentation such as occur today. But most people wouldn't listen. But now it's interesting that more and more geologists are saying the same thing. For example, the book, The Nature of the Stratigraphic Record, by Dr. Derek Ager, who, when he wrote this, was president of the British Geological Association and is head of the geological department at the University of Swansea in England. In this book has done exactly what I said a moment ago, showing that all of the geological systems and structures and formations require some kind of catastrophe for their explanation. And he goes one by one over all the different kinds. Now, he's not a creationist, don't misunderstand. He's a uniformitarian geologist, but he does say that in order to explain the geological systems, you have to have catastrophes. Here, for example, on page 49, he says, the hurricane, the flood, the tsunami may do more in an hour or a day than the ordinary processes of nature can achieve in 1,000 years. That sounds something like another book. One day is with a catastrophe as 1,000 years, he's saying. In other words, you don't have to have millions of years to explain the rocks of the Earth's crust. They can be formed rapidly. And the evidence, hydraulically, is that they are. And as a matter of fact, paleontologically, too, because after all, these rocks contain fossils, great graveyards of fossils all over the world. You have great beds of dinosaurs in Wyoming and New Mexico and Alberta and Spitsbergen and South Africa and Belgium and Central Asia and all great beds of dinosaurs everywhere and great beds of elephants up in the permafrost in Siberia and Alaska and beds of hippopotamus in Sicily and so on, great fish beds in California and New York and Wyoming and Scotland and How, for example, do you explain a billion fossil herring in the Miocene shales near Monterey in California? How do you get a billion fossil fish? Remember, fossils are formed by sedimentary processes, water-moving sediments deposited underwater. And yet here we have a billion fossil fish. Fish don't drown, and yet there they are, a billion fossil fish. How do you get that? How do you even get one fossil fish? When fish die, they don't go down to the bottom of the ocean or the lake and wait for 100 years for silt to settle on top and make a fossil out of them. You have to have a catastrophe to form fossil beds of any size. And then, of course, you have great beds of marine invertebrates all over the world. So the rocks just seem to cry out catastrophism. That's what Dr. Ager says. In fact, the very last sentence of his book, he says this: in other words, the history of any one part of the earth, like the life of a soldier, consists of long periods of boredom and short periods of terror. What you see in the rocks is catastrophe. Now, don't misunderstand. He doesn't think they were all the same catastrophe. He doesn't think this is the flood of the Bible or anything like that. He thinks these were all local floods, local earthquakes, local tsunamis, local landslides or whatnot, local catastrophes. But what he does say is that everything you see in the rocks is a catastrophe. Now, he thinks that each one of these was a regional catastrophe separated from the next one maybe by a million years when nothing much was happening, boredom, periods of erosion rather than deposition. But now we would ask this: well, if everything you see is catastrophism, just how do you know there are millions of years in between since you can't see any evidence of it? After all, science is what you see, and all you see in the rocks is catastrophism. And there are many other geologists now who are saying the same kind of thing. Well, as a matter of fact, the creation model doesn't necessarily have to pin it all on one catastrophe, but the more you look at these phenomena, the more it looks like they're the same catastrophe. For example, let me move the slide again. Consider the concept of unconformity. Now, as long as the rock strata are parallel to each other, they conform to each other, and they're all laid down by sedimentary processes, you can assume that the deposition process is continuous, particularly if at the interface between the successive layers or strata you find irregularities representing the rippled interface on the sediment is being transported, and you find this nearly always. They're conformable because they're all continuous and parallel, and so as long as you find that, then you know that you've got a continuous deposition process. But if you have an unconformity where the strata above do not conform to those below, as shown here, then the supposition is that there's been a gap of time, a lapse of time, and this is a period of erosion rather than deposition. And of course, it might be a long time. May I have the next slide? Now, the important point, however, on that is that there is no such thing as a worldwide unconformity, and therefore no worldwide lapse in deposition. Dr. K. Hong Chang in the Geological Society of America Bulletin, article entitled Unconformity Bounded Stratigraphic Units, November 1975, says this: in the early history of stratigraphy, unconformities were overestimated in that they were believed to represent coeval diastrophism over areas of infinitely wide extent. In other words, he's saying that back there 100 years ago, during the days of Cuvier, before Lyell and Darwin, there were believed to be at the end of each of the great ages, the end of the Cambrian period, the Ordovician period, and so on, a worldwide mountain-building revolution, therefore a worldwide unconformity, a gap in time representing the end of one age and the beginning of another age. Dr. Chang so points out that this was overestimated. Now, of course, it's known that there is no worldwide unconformity like that. Unconformities are all local, and furthermore, even local unconformities do not necessarily tell the time when one age stopped or even one deposition stopped and another began, except on a very local scale. Dr. Chang says this: many unconformity bounded units are considered to be chronostratigraphic units in spite of the fact that unconformity surfaces inevitably cut across isochronous horizons and hence cannot be true chronostratigraphic boundaries. Now, if you sift through the jargon there, an isochronous horizon is one on which the time is the same, isochronous, equal time. So below that is earlier, and above that is later. So isochronous does mean a given point in time. But the unconformity surfaces did not, because he says they inevitably cut across isochronous horizons. So you cannot use unconformities to measure geological time. Now, he also points out, of course, that there is no worldwide unconformity. Now, do you see the significance of that? If there is no worldwide unconformity, there is no worldwide gap in the deposition process. The deposition process is going on continuously somewhere in the world throughout geological time. And combine that with the evidence of universal catastrophe everywhere, Dr. Ager says, every individual formation was formed by a local catastrophe, and all that you see is catastrophe, and then the whole series is continuous because there's no worldwide gap in deposition. In other words, you can start at the bottom of the geological column anywhere and work your way to the top, and you may have to zigzag around a bit, but as this sketch indicates, even though there may be an unconformity at one section where there was an uplift and therefore tilting of the strata and a gap in deposition and a period of erosion at the one section, at the other section there was not. And so all you have to do is to go around, if you encounter an unconformity, move along to the side somewhere till you get to the place where the strata straighten out and you can pass up into the next formation without going through an unconformity, and then into the next one. So you can go all the way from the bottom up to the top, zigzagging around like that, and the trace that you follow like that is a trace along which the deposition process was continuous, no unconformity being crossed. And since every unit was formed rapidly by at least a local catastrophe, therefore the whole series is a series of continuous local catastrophes. And you can do that anywhere in the world, starting at any point at the bottom of the geological column. And finally, it seems like we're compelled to come to the conclusion that the whole complex represents a series of local catastrophes, all interconnected and continuous, comprising finally a great worldwide hydraulic cataclysm, so that the whole geological column really represents the same catastrophe. Primarily, there may be some local catastrophes afterwards in the upper strata, but basically, one great catastrophe. And that means then that the geological age system, which is supposedly represented by the geological column, really comes under serious question. If all of this was formed in the same age, then where do we get the idea that each one of these represents different ages? Where, for example, do you get the idea that there are different geological ages? How do you know what the age of Iraq is, for example? If you go out onto the mountain and you find a rock and you want to know what the age is, how do you know what the age of the rock is? Well, everybody just believes that geologists know how to do that. Old rocks look old and young rocks look young somewhere, they can tell. But the fact is, old rocks don't necessarily look old or young rocks look young. And the determination of the geological age is really rather sophisticated. I see that my time is about up. Whenever I get to talking about geological time, I run out of time, looks like. So maybe I can continue this at the second session, just to point out at this time that there is no really completely objective scientific way for determining the geological age of Iraq. There's no real reason why they couldn't all be the same age, and all form, therefore, in the same great cataclysm as the basic creation model would suggest. Whether, therefore, we look at the present world or the past world, the creation model does serve as a powerful vehicle and a model for explaining and correlating the scientific data. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed Dr. Morris's presentation very much. I think that we have seen something remarkable, and that is that Dr. Morris has attempted to give a marvelous critique of evolution, but for some reason he has said very little about special creation. And I think it is reasonable to say that one, it's going to take me all week if you do that. I think it's reasonable to say, if we're going to compare two theories, we have to look very carefully at both of them. And I propose that we should take a few minutes and see what it is that Dr. Morris says we should put in place of evolution. Now, first of all, he is not merely arguing creation. You see, I'm a creationist too, because I'm a Roman Catholic. And therefore, I believe that the world was created. And I believe that there is meaning and purpose to existence. Most scientists, by that definition, in one sense or another, are creationists. So what do we got to argue about? Well, the answer is that we have everything to argue about. See, what Dr. Morris proposes is special creation, which is a theory that proposes certain very specific things about the origin of the universe. And to me, the remarkable thing about his statement was that he mentioned very few of those things. Now, it is true that special creation has a religious character to it. But Dr. Morris wants to debate on science and science alone, and that's fine. I agree with it, and I hold him to it. So let's have a look. Now, you can find all about special creation in some of the books that Dr. Morris has put together. Could we have all the lights that can be turned off, and the first slide, please? If possible, yeah, very good, thank you. Okay, this is a book called Scientific Creationism, which Dr. Morris edited. Really neat cover. I would love to have the artist that illustrated that to do my next paper. I'm just delighted with that. And it's a book which I recommend to all of you. I got a copy myself. It's well written. It's very clear. It's authoritatively documented. Go ahead, go out and buy it, Dr. Morris. You owe me a beer for the plug. Now, here's what the book will tell you. First of all, the entire universe is 6 to 10,000 years old. It's 6 to 10,000 years old. All animals and plants, all living things, were created in a very short period of time. Might have taken about 6 days. And nothing has come into existence since then. Nothing has come into existence. Variation in living things now is limited to original created kinds. And that's within very strict boundaries. And finally, all fossils of the various geologic periods were in fact formed at one time. A great worldwide catastrophe about which we've just heard, which probably was a flood, and probably lasted about 300 days. Now, you know that evolution suggests something very different. So I agree with Dr. Morris. We should be able to look into the world and look at the facts around us and tell the difference. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Number one, age of the universe. Okay, the universe is 10,000 years old. And that means that we should not be able to see any stars or galaxies farther away than about 10,000 light years, because that's how long it takes the light to travel, right? Okay, next slide. Dr. Morris is in trouble, in big trouble right away. This is the Whirlpool Galaxy. It's one of the prettiest galaxies. That's why I brought it. I like pictures. I'm a microscopist. I'm into images. And the Whirlpool Galaxy is several million light years from Earth. We can see it. We can take its picture. The light is here. And a straightforward interpretation of that is that there have been at least a couple of million years for that light to get here. Now the problem gets worse, and it gets 1,000 times worse. Next slide. This is the most distant object ever visualized in the universe. It's by the arrow, the lower right-hand corner of the slide. It's a galaxy that was reported in the press a couple of months ago as being discovered by the orbiting Einstein X-ray Observatory. It is 12 billion light years away. Now, astronomers realize that when we look at this light, we are looking into the past. We are looking at events that occurred 12 billion years ago. Now, this is an immediate contradiction for special creation. How can they deal with it? Well, Dr. Morris has thought about this, and there is a book which he wrote with someone else named The Genesis Flood. And on page 369 of The Genesis Flood, he deals with that question, and he says, it, meaning the universe, must have had an appearance of age from the moment of creation. The photons of light energy from places like this were created at the same instant as the stars from which they were apparently derived. In other words, the reason we can see these things is because the Creator made all of the photons in midstream at the instant of creation, and therefore we can see it today. So in other words, they have to get around this very serious problem by saying that the Creator has organized his universe in a way so as to fool us. Now, moreover, because we frequently see events like supernovae and disintegration, stars exploding and so forth, at distances greater than 100,000 light years, it means the Creator is making up events that never occurred. Because if we see a star explode at 100,000 light years away, and the universe is only 10,000 light years old, it means he put the photons documenting an explosion in midstream that never actually took place in reality. Now, what a devil, no pun intended, that Creator must have been. Now, if Dr. Morris wants to believe that, that's fine. But he certainly shouldn't pretend that there's any scientific support for the idea that the universe is 10,000 years old. Now, I want you to note something. If the universe was young, we could tell it. We really could. If the most distant star that we could see was 10,000 light years away, and if every night a new star or two twinkled up in the sky, one light day farther away, every astronomer in the world would be on Dr. Morris's side. Instead, we see something else. And what does special creation have to do about the evidence for the age of the universe? It has to say, as it will say again, that the evidence doesn't matter. Okay, number two, how old is the Earth? Well, it's 6 to 10,000 years old, right? Okay. How could we tell that? Well, the most convincing way that we could do that would be by radiometric dating. Now, there are many, many ways to do it. But I will try to explain one of those methods in detail. It will involve a little graphs, charts, that sort of thing. Thing we dig in science and people out in the real world don't like very much, but I urge you to bear with me. Yeah, the next slide. What I'm going to talk about is a method called rubidium-strontium dating. And what it involves and takes advantage of it is the fact that one isotope of rubidium, rubidium-87, decays by a process known as electron capture into an isotope of strontium called strontium-87. It decays with a half-life that has been very accurately measured and comes out at about 50 billion years. And that means in 50 billion years, half of the rubidium would have decayed to strontium 87 and so forth. Now, the really neat thing about this is that there are three other isotopes of strontium, as you can see, which are not formed by radiometric decay. The apparent, the present proportions of those in the Earth's crust is shown as percentages in brackets. As you can see, about 7% of the strontium in the Earth's crust now is formed by this process. Now, how do we determine the amounts of these various things? Now, that turns out to be very easy. Next slide. We take a sample of rock and we place that sample in a machine known as a mass spectrometer. The very accurate versions of these machines only exist in the last 25 years, so only in the last 25 years can we determine the proportions of these accurately. And the next slide shows the sorts of measurements you get out of these things, and that is that we can develop peaks which have very accurate measurements of the apparent abundances of the different isotopes. Now, the investigator in this one, if you're close enough to see it, has made a little mark saying that a certain amount of the strontium 87 is radiogenic, and that means it was formed by radioactive decay from rubidium. Now, how did he do that? I mean, is he fudging it? Is he using a presumption of evolution? I'll show you how it's done. Next slide. Now,